From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. America's changing demographics are getting a lot of attention in the recent post-election analysis, but it's hardly the first time in U.S. history that population has stirred policymakers and policy. Some of the nation's founders saw a growing population as an economic boon. Others feared more babies meant more poverty. In a new book, the historian Derek Hough traces the population debate through slavery, westward expansion, eugenics, reproductive rights, climate change, and more. And today on the program, we're talking with Hough about the nation's ever-changing and ever-growing population. Plus, male bonding over parenthood, Salt Lake acting companies manning up. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From 2 million inhabitants in revolutionary times to 315 million today, the population of the U.S. has seen exponential growth over the past 250 years. And while the increase has brought economic prosperity, it's also spawned many fears, from exhausting finite resources to providing for aging baby boomers. Today on the program, we're talking about the intersection between population and policy with the historian Derek Hough. He's an associate professor of history at Kansas State University, where he specializes in the history of American politics, public policy, economic and business history, and the history of demographic ideas. His new book is titled The State and the Stork: The Population Debate and Policymaking in the U.S., published by the University of Chicago Press. And Derek Hough is in studio. He is visiting his wife, who works here in Salt Lake City. Derek, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks very much for having me, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, we turn to the pressures of population growth on two men, two fictional men, the latest production of Salt Lake acting company's play called Manning Up. But first, the population debate. In an age of global warming and birth control and demographic voting blocks, do you think we're talking about population growth too much or not enough? You can join our conversation this morning. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Derek Hough, you're a historian. What got you thinking about the population debate and the history of population growth in America?
I think it was because my mom dated someone who was a member of the zero population growth movement in the 1960s. So it was a completely random way to come to the topic. Plus, I really needed a good dissertation topic in graduate
school. Of course. So were you sitting around the kitchen table with your mother talking about population issues and wondering, why did you have me, Mom?
No, but already by the time I got to college and graduate school, I noticed that really nobody in the United States was talking about this question that 30 years ago was a really important part of public policy discussion. And when there were 200 million Americans in the late 1960s, many Americans were really concerned about overpopulation. And there was this zero population growth movement. And yet 30, 40 years later, when the population is over 300 million, you really don't hear too many people talking about it, except for a few voices on the left and a few voices on the right.
And so you wanted to explore how population kind of figured into the historical narrative over time?
Yeah, the book chronicles, first and foremost, the strange disappearance of this overpopulation critique since about 1970. But well beyond that, it goes back and it looks at the historic debates about population even before the United States became the United States. And it shows how population issues have intersected with a variety of important policy questions. And it shows that population debates have really been central to American policy discussions, again, all the way until just the last generation.
We're going to go through how the views have changed over time about population growth, how some policymakers and economists and social scientists have either advocated policies to encourage birth rates or to lower them. But I guess I'm wondering just generally, if population, how is population influenced by policy? Or is it just nature taking over?
Well, Americans and most people in the world don't respond to their government when it comes to having babies.
Sure.
It's obviously a very private decision. And so even in the height of the zero population growth movement in the 1960s, which was concerned about the exhaustion of natural resources and almost created a scare about population growth. Even then, advocates of a lower population didn't really call for draconian policies. They didn't call for a heavy tax on a third child or anything radical like that, anything approaching China's one-child policy. It's always been at the level primarily of education and advocacy and population experts trying to show people what they perceive as a population problem. That said, of course, there are many major policies that influence America's demography. Obviously, immigration levels are first and foremost, because today in the United States, immigration accounts for a significant percentage of population growth. Obviously, if you look at the politics of birth control in this election, family planning policy has not a tremendous demographic impact. People will find a way to have family planning, regardless of whether policymakers try to take it away from them. And abortion, too, obviously, is demographically significant, although probably not as much as people would assume in terms of actually affecting birth rates.
Hmm. Speaking with Derek Hoff, he's an associate professor of history at Kansas State University and the author of the new book, The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policymaking in U.S. History. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. What do you make of the recent analysis of, you know, changing demographics in the shadow of the recent election, the growth of Latino voters? I mean, as a historian, how do you put that all into context?
Well, it's part of an amazing story, which a lot of Americans, I think, don't realize, is that the United States is such a demographic outlier in the wealthy, industrialized world. Because you turn on the TV and sometimes you hear a story about Japan or Italy or Russia, nations that are going to see their populations flatten or even decline in the next century. And the United States, remarkably, has always had high fertility levels. And that shows no signs of abating, although it certainly dipped down the last couple of years with the recession. But the Census Bureau projects that in 2050, which isn't that far off, there are going to be 439 million Americans. And in the year 2100, there are going to be 570 million Americans, which is kind of an eye-popping number to a lot of people who don't think about this topic. And, the Latino population is a significantly growing one, and that's part of the story. But really, across the board, America is a demographic outlier.
You begin your examination in the book in colonial times, and you note that the ideas of Thomas Malthus have played a huge role in population discussions. Tell us about this man.
Well, he was a British pastor, and he wrote a very famous book called An Essay on Population in 1799, and he made the argument that you still hear some environmentalists make to this day, which is that eventually population growth outstrips the supply of natural resources. And in particular, he was most interested just in the sheer amount of food that societies could produce and calories. He didn't take into account climate change or biodiversity or any of the things that we talk about. So Malthus warned that population would ruin societies, would make everyone poor, would drive down the wages of the working class on the road to what we would call environmental collapse. And Malthus has been both, of course, loved and hated by Americans ever since. He was fiercely debated by Americans in the first quarter of the 19th century. I think he was more respected in pre-Civil War America than many historians assume.
It's a rather grim, pessimistic view of the world. Did he have political motives for advancing this theory?
Well, he has been vilified on the left for essentially saying that the problem is too many people. The problem is not structural inequality. The problem is not that the rich guys are taking all of the resources.
It's just volume.
So, exactly. And sometimes conservatives have tried to use Malthusian arguments to oppose charity. The argument that, it just doesn't make any sense to give to the poor because then they'll just have more babies if they momentarily get higher incomes, and then they'll just repopulate themselves into poverty. So he has been sort of seen as a kind of conservative reactionary figure. But I think that's a bit unfair. He actually was genuinely concerned with the working class. He was genuinely concerned with trying to give more people a higher standard of living.
So we move from Malthus to the westward expansion and Andrew Jackson's Manifest Destiny. You write that Manifest Destiny extended the Republican tradition of seeing to diffuse social tensions through geographic growth. So basically, if you get too many people in one area, spread them out.
Manifest Destiny, the idea that white Americans have the right, maybe even the duty, to populate the entire continent, to spread across the populent, the continent. Populent, I just invented a new term there.
Love it.
For the United States. Manifest Destiny, on some level, was an incredible celebration of population growth. The idea is we white, supposed Anglo-Saxons, we are exploding our population. We are growing. We have a superior civilization. We are going to spread all the way to the Pacific Ocean, you know, and the rest of you be damned. That was the idea. And yet, underneath that kind of celebration of American population growth, there is a real lingering anxiety about population. In a sense, the argument many Americans made in the 19th century was we need to expand westward, because if we don't, we won't have that safety valve for our growing population. And therefore, we'll become like Europe. We'll have these teeming, dangerous, class-stratified cities on the east if we don't allow ourselves to expand west. So Manifest Destiny was both a celebration of population growth, and it really reflected this Malthusian anxiety about too many people bottled up in the east.
You mentioned that there was a racial strain to Manifest Destiny, that it was an Anglo-Saxon driven, keep the white race pure and powerful.
Yeah, and race is never far from the discussion about population growth in the United States, as we've already touched on. And in fact, one of the reasons that the population issue has disappeared in the last 30 years is that it has been tainted with, racialized ideas. And, look at the issue today, when immigration does account for a significant percentage of population growth. Many people who maybe 30 years ago were comfortable talking about the environmental consequences of population growth, maybe progressives, they're very concerned with talking about population growth today, because to do so is to talk about immigration, and therefore they're afraid of being tainted with the charge of being racist.
Speaking with Derek Koff, he's an associate professor of history at Kansas State University, author of the new book, The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policymaking in U.S. History. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Speaking of racism, in the turn of the century, we saw the rise of eugenics and social Darwinism. I mean, was this racism under the cloak of genetic superiority? This idea that, explain what eugenics is.
Well, eugenics is the nasty idea dominant at the turn of the century, but certainly, percolated into the mid-20th century, you can still see vestiges of it today, is that we need to breed a better population. And eugenicists believed that they could breed a better population by encouraging births among the so-called genetically fit, which not surprisingly tended to be white, college-educated people, and then by discouraging births among the genetically unfit, which not surprisingly tended to be people of color, people in mental institutions, et cetera. So this was a dominant idea, particularly in the 1920s, when huge swaths of white Americans were attracted to the idea of eugenics. And yet I also suggest in the book that we should remember that racism has a long history, and that garden variety racism is not the same as eugenics. And there were many, many opponents of the eugenics movement throughout its history.
Hmm. Overpopulation. You note that it has been a concern, not just on an economic front, but that population needed to be controlled because there were scarce resources. That idea seemed to give birth, pardon the pun, to the movement of contraceptive rights and the pill and Margaret Sanger and reproductive rights. And you go into that in some detail in the book, just talking about how, these ideas really influenced individual lives, too. It's not just a big policy thing.
Yeah, I mean, the battle for contraceptive rights was first and foremost a battle for women's rights. Margaret Sanger used the argument that we need to control the population. But I think it's very fair to say that, women's advocates emphasize women's rights first and not the population argument. But it is true that, by the 1960s, we're going to see a convergence between the family planning movement, the population movement, and the abortion rights movement. So all of these reproductive rights movements are going to be combined in the 1960s. And in fact, population groups, those advocating for a lower population, are among some of the first groups in the 1960s to be arguing for the liberalization of abortion laws. And that's actually something that pro-choice groups today don't like to talk about too much because they don't want to be associated with that population movement for a number of reasons.
Mm. Derek Hoff, again, an associate professor of history at Kansas State University, the author of the new book, The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policymaking in U.S. History. We're talking about population growth and how changing demographics have challenged policymakers over American history. And you can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about changing ideas about population growth in the United States. From founders like John Adams, who called population expansion the surest indication of national happiness, to President John F. Kennedy, who called the booming birth rate a tremendous problem. We're getting a whole range of perspectives over time with the historian Derek Hoff, author of the new book, The State and the Stork. And if you'd like to join our conversation, does a growing population worry you? Do you think today's policymakers are talking about demographic changes too much or not enough? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones, and let's go to Charlie, who's calling from Salt Lake City. Charlie, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Well, my question is, I work in the investment world, so I know with our financial crisis, we have to continue to grow to get out of the mess, and yet growth is kind of doomsday. What is your solution?
Well, this is an historian's perspective. I don't know if you've got a solution, Derek Hoff, but I mean, this is a question that has vexed a lot of economists and social theorists over the ages. You want to have an expanding economy. You want to have growth, prosperity, and yet there are finite resources.
Yeah, thanks for the question. What that question actually reflects is the dominant idea that has taken off really only in the last 30, 40 years, which is that you must have population growth to grow the economy. And what my book looks at a lot is how, for a couple hundred years, many Americans argued that a slowing population growth would actually be good for the economy, that in fact you could have healthy levels of what we would call per capita economic growth without growing, just relying on sheer numbers of bodies. In the middle of the 20th century, the dominant idea was fewer people would actually be good for all of us because it would force the economy to produce more for every person. So we would have a higher consumption economy. Each person would enjoy a better standard of living.
Does the growth have to be internal? I mean, can we have a growing economy by broadening our exports and the growing in markets outside of the United States instead of relying on internal population growth?
Absolutely. And sheer body counts don't really account for economic growth that much. One of the fascinating things is a lot of conservative economists still talk about the need for population growth. And yet, you know, they also emphasize innovation and education and human capital and all the things we know grow economies. And it's so funny that we tend to think of this sort of old-fashioned, oh, you need to produce more bodies to create economic growth. And, of course, what you need is a higher educated workforce and more innovation and all the things that are all the buzzwords today.
Charlie, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. There have been, as you note in your book, there have been concerted efforts by governments to encourage population, encourage birth rates, or to discourage. I'm thinking of one in the 1950s I'd never even heard of, something called the Population Council. Can you describe what the goal was there and this linkage that we alluded to between population growth and poverty?
Yeah, the Population Council is still a leading organization today.
Shows you what I know.
Working on family planning in what we would call the developing world. The argument that population growth induces poverty is as old as Malthus. And we saw a return of that idea in the 1960s when, in fact, population was linked to President Johnson's war on poverty. And the idea is we're going to promote family planning in the United States. And in the 1960s, we see for the first time the emergence of federally sponsored family planning programs. And the argument was that would help reduce poverty. But of course, it's the United States. So this idea was immediately racialized. And immediately critics said, oh, what this is about is trying to give birth control to people of color.
So it became a racial issue. Talk about the role that religion has played in this whole debate. I mean, clearly we saw this in the last election, very recently, talking about birth control and whether or not healthcare plans should be subsidizing that and expand
on
that.
One of the reasons that America has the highest birth rate in the developed world right now is that it's a more religious nation than, of course, just about every nation in Europe, And evangelicals do have more babies today than non-evangelicals. So that's part of the story, that since 1970, as evangelicals have grown in strength in America, that has further reduced the kind of momentum for talking about population and reducing population. But in the 1960s, during the height of this zero population growth movement, most mainstream Protestant churches were very supportive of the idea that America had to do something about its exponentially rising population. The question of the Catholic Church on population, of course, is enormously complicated and long, and there were plenty of divisions between moderate Catholics and conservative Catholics, and all of this was up in the air in the 1960s because it seemed for a moment after Vatican II that the Church might change its position on birth control, and of course it did not.
Well, we can't talk about religion without mentioning the LDS Church, which is dominant here in the state of Utah, and Mormon families are known to have very large numbers of children in their families.
Utah has the highest fertility rate in the nation, at least most years. You know, Utah is growing at 2% a year versus 1% for the national average. So, you know, we have all of these issues here in Utah magnified throughout, you know, that the whole country is facing. Utah is very urbanized. You've got an enormous metro area abutting, you know, beautiful, spectacular natural land. So, you know, population issues are central to the Utah experience going forward. I'm not an expert on LDS ideas about population or demography. In fact, I searched at one point for Brigham Young's writings on population, and I didn't get very far. But obviously, like most Americans of the 19th century, there was a, you know, celebration of burgeoning families. Mm.
Speaking with Derek Hoff, an associate professor of history at Kansas State University and author of the new book, The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policymaking in U.S. History. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So we've had these ups and downs when it comes to population theory and if it's a good thing or if it's a bad thing. You say in your book that we really have not talked about the population debate for the past 40 years. I mean, why has this become such a non-issue?
Well, there are many factors, of course. The decline of the environmental movement is certainly an important factor. The zero population growth movement was very much a part of a growing environmental movement of the 1960s. And this last election certainly showed that really mainstream Americans are not talking about the environment at all. We've already talked about the culture wars. So the idea of reducing population was a kind of bipartisan, non-controversial idea in the 50s and 60s. And yet in the 1970s and 80s, this idea got sucked into the vortex of the culture wars, and in particularly abortion. And the pro-life side did not want to be associated with the population movement, and of course, immigration. And as I said, to talk about population now is to go into the minefield of immigration politics and racial politics, and also shifting economic ideas. What the State and the Stork really focuses on is a new set of ideas among conservative economists in the 1960s and 1970s that celebrated population growth, that said it was an unabashed good, that discarded 200 years of economic theory going all the way back to the classical economists of the 19th century, whom ironically most conservative economists today really celebrate. But on this particular point, they diverge. And the idea became that population creates economies of scale and grows the economy, and population makes more geniuses. And in the end, individual fertility decisions will serve the common good. There's an invisible hand of childbirth. And these are the ideas, I think, that have led to a bipartisan celebration of population growth really across the political spectrum, except for a few environmental voices on the left that still talk about it, and a few anti-immigration voices on the right who will use the population argument kind of cynically to oppose immigration.
But it's not been mainstream for years.
That's exactly right. And the silence on the issue in the last election, I think, perfectly shows that.
Is this the market knows best demography concept that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest story here is the rejection of Malthusian ideas is part and parcel with the conservative ascendancy in the final third of the 20th century, the dominance of market-oriented economic ideas that, yes, human beings are sort of brilliant and whatever they do will kind of magically work itself out. And just as if whatever whatever market activity promotes the common good, your childbearing decisions will kind of magically work themselves out for society.
Even though you argue that it's not a mainstream, kind of top of mind agenda topic, the question about population growth is at the edges of so many other pressing issues. And I'm thinking of Social Security and Medicare. We have this huge baby boomer population, and yet we have fewer young people in the workforce who can help pay for those services. I mean, that's a huge issue. And population really is at the center of that.
And that's another reason that both Democrats and Republicans today mostly celebrate population growth. The caller talked about growth to get out of the fiscal crisis. Well, what that means, of course, is increasing workers who can pay taxes. And because the birth rate did dip a little bit in the 1970s on the heels of the baby boom, we still have this bulge of people that are now retired, the baby boomers. And it is quite a challenge, obviously, to pay for their health care and retirement bill. And yet this idea of an aging crisis that I talk about in the book, and you hear that today, that we're going to be bankrupted by the aging of the baby boomers. We still as a society can afford to pay for these people. It is a public policy matter. We can tax ourselves as we see fit. We can adjust retirement ages. Demography is not necessarily destiny here. So I think the idea of an aging crisis has been somewhat overblown, and it reflects a desire among I think conservatives to cut the welfare state to make sure that welfare spending does not increase. But there's no reason that we can't borrow ourselves or tax ourselves out of this aging crisis.
Hmm. Is the so-called aging crisis, is that the fruit of the zero population movement? Can you link the two?
No, the aging crisis is in fact a reaction to the zero population growth movement. The aging crisis emerged in the 1970s, and in some ways I think it actually was a backlash to the Malthusian ideas of the 1960s, because the idea of an aging crisis calls for more babies, because it's babies that are going to get us out of that by creating more workers. And this is why you have, liberal newspapers saying we need more babies and more immigrants today to pay for grandma. And that is easier than increasing taxes on the wealthy. That is easier than asking old people to work a couple more years. So, having more babies is kind of just an easy solution for everything.
Hmm. Even if population isn't, the leading issue of the day, I mean, do you see that it will gain traction? Do you see that this issue is going to become more and more important, or at least more important to the policymakers out there?
Well, my wife can tell you about what a bad prognosticator I am, but I do think the issue is steadily gaining attention because, again, America is such an outlier that it's going to go to 570 million. And I think if we can ever, as a society, maybe have a calm debate about climate change and biodiversity, I think population issues will re-enter that discussion. Because on another level, we may begin to see a return to ideas about the quality of life. So much of the zero population growth movement in the 1960s was a very dire discussion about starving and running out of resources. And we realized that that was wrong, that we can support a lot more people. The question is, at what standard of living? And at what point do we lose that open, wide open American lifestyle? At what point do we begin to kind of, denigrate the Wasatch Front? Even though we can probably survive with a billion Americans, to some level, I think people are going to start to ask, well, how many Americans do we want for the continent of society that we want to enjoy?
So you don't see a return to the kind of doom and gloom rhetoric from someone like Paul Ehrlich, who really was very alarmist mm-hmm. in the way that he described population growth and was a leader of the zero population growth movement.
I think environmentalists and I think progressives have learned that doom and gloom rhetoric doesn't get them very far. It backfires. And again, I think, economists have made several excellent arguments. Markets do substitute. You know, when you run out of natural resources, humans do innovate new products. We have grown more food. But look at the local food movement. We've proven we can feed a lot more people. But do we want to all eat industrial food? So again, the questions will not be survival. They will be about quality of life and environmental health and maybe even softer considerations like the need for solitude or quiet or, again, more open lands and wilderness. So I don't think we're going to see a return to a kind of dire zero population growth movement. At least I hope we don't, because then at that point things are going to be getting very bad in terms of the natural environment.
Mm. Going back 250 years of population policy and the debates surrounding and the theories, I mean, what have you learned? What do you take from this study?
I've learned that demographers are very bad predictors. in the 1930s, demographers predicted that the American population would peak at 170 million. So we don't know what the population is going to look like in 100 years. I've learned that, but I've also learned that Americans for a couple hundred years were very concerned with this issue, and it was part of mainstream policy discussion. And that has been lost only in the last generation.
And did you learn that policy makes a difference in this issue or not?
Well, in terms of driving population growth or in changing people's attitudes?
You take your pick.
Obviously, policy matters a lot for population trends. But in the end, I think people decide to have babies based on very personal ideological decisions. Their religion, their expectation of economic growth in the future, and perhaps even their views about population growth. One of the things that zero population growth movement did is convince Americans to have fewer babies. Whenever I meet parents of a certain generation that had kids in the early 1970s, I frequently hear them tell me, well, we stopped at two then, because that's just what you did. And that wasn't government decision. That was a moment when Americans talked about this, and more Americans than today or before decided to have two children.
Do you think young people are thinking about these issues today?
No, I don't. If they are, they're thinking about, in terms of American exceptionalism, they're thinking about, let's have as many kids as we can. If they don't have kids, it's because of very short-term things like the Great Recession, or they've lost their house and they've had to move in with mom. But I don't think that many young people are thinking about this issue.
Is that a good thing? A bad thing?
Well, it depends on your politics, right? Progressives would argue we've absolutely got to start talking about this when we confront a climate change and a warming planet. And conservatives say that population growth is what has given us our incredible wealth in this nation.
Derek Hoff, he's an associate professor of history at Kansas State University. His new book is titled The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policymaking in U.S. History. And Professor Hoff, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, small-scale population growth on the stage, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Take two fathers-to-be, throw them in a man cave, and let their fears and fantasies about parenthood take over. That's kind of the plot of the latest production by Salt Lake Acting Company. And today on the program, we're exploring the humor, the anxiety, the friendship at the center of the play, Manning Up. Joining me in studio, Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie. They are executive producers of Salt Lake Acting Company. And Cynthia and Kevin, great to have you here again. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Also joining us by phone, Lanny Langston. He is making his first appearance at Salt Lake Acting Company in the role of Donnie in Manning Up. And Lanny joining us by phone from his classroom at Brighton High School. Lanny, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the program today. And hi, Cynthia and Kevin.
Hey, Lanny.
Hey, Lanny.
Thanks for joining us. Salt Lake Acting Company's production of Manning Up continues through Sunday, December 9th, in the company's Chapel Theater. We'll give you some more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, if you're expecting a new little one, do you identify with the anxieties of parenthood as portrayed in Manning Up? You can join us with your stories. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Kevin, this is the world premiere of Manning Up by Sean Christopher Lewis. Tell us a bit more about the play. I gave it just a one sentence, but can you expand on that?
Yes. This is Sean Christopher Lewis's first comedy, and he has been working on a play about Utah. He lives back in the Midwest, and I had asked him last spring if he had done any more work on it, and he said no, but he had this comedy that he had been working on and thought, would it be okay if he sent that out instead? So he sent that back in, I don't know, March, April, and read it and thought it was funny. At that point, it was called Baby Bump, and passed it along to Cynthia, and she enjoyed it as well, and so it ended up in the season, and it's part of a rolling world premiere. A Riverside Theater in Iowa did it first. They closed right before us, so Sean Christopher Lewis was able to develop there, and we're the second one, and then it's going on to another one in the spring. And it's part of the National New Play Network, which part of their Continued Life Fund, which ensures a playwright a chance, an opportunity to have three productions go on within the course of a year. Because it's very hard for a playwright to get productions after the initial world premiere at a theater. Mm. So this ensures them development work beyond that first production. Mm. And yes, it is a comedy about two guys, not stuck in their man cave, but kind of like, or hiding from their wives upstairs for the evening.
Two first-time dads. I mean, Cynthia Fleming, what was it about this play that just wanted you to put it on the stage?
Well, from a woman's point of view, which I am, it was a voice I hadn't heard of before. It seems like more focus is on the woman, as it should be, the health of the woman, what kind of mother I'm going to be. And that starts when, as soon as you conceive, and how you take care of your baby, how many books you read, how many apps you put on your phone now. that kind of says what kind of mother you're going to be. But never once did I ever even personally, you know, wonder if my husband was thinking of what kind of father I'm going to be. Mm-hmm. Am I man enough? How is my life going to change? And this play presents this voice in a very funny and also very touching way. And what we have found with the audience is I feel that the women are really charmed by this play because it's something that we're not used to. It was almost like with Love, Loss, and What I Wore, all the men that were kind of dancing out of the theater because they're like got these special insights into women that they have kind of recognized but never heard it articulated before. And so it's that same kind of thing with the sexes.
So women, if you want to figure out what your men are thinking,
yes.
You can go see Manning Up. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about Manning Up, the latest production by Salt Lake Acting Company. It runs through Sunday, December 9th. With me in studio, Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie, the executive producers, and Lanny Langston, who is the role of Donnie in Manning Up. And Lanny, describe your character for us. Who is Donnie?
Yeah, sure. Donnie is a expectant first-time father who is a college professor. And he out of the two, he's a little bit more of the sensitive type, I guess. And so he's a little more open to talking about some of the fears and frustrations he's having about being a father, although both men certainly have them. But within the play, it's now getting down to crunch time where the women are about to pop any moment now, and so all of these fears that he has, he really feels like he's got to solve these as soon as possible because he's really worried that he's not going to be manly enough, He's not going to be a good enough husband, not going to be a good enough father, for his children and his wife. And so that he's trying to figure that out with his more manly friend, Raymond.
I understand that in real life you're a father and that, in fact, you're expecting a second child. When you read the script for Manning Up, what rang true to you?
Oh, sure. I think the main thing that rang true for me is a similar fear that Donnie has. Is I really was, and it was kind of weird. I was worried that, like, I might not, like, be a man yet, you know? And, like, it seems, you know, being a father, especially, and a husband as well, it seems like, you know, that's something you should be, you know, if you're going to be a father. But I kind of still felt like a boy, and I worried about, like, protecting my daughter and maybe that I wasn't mature enough. But once the baby, you know, comes out, it's like all those things just kind of seem to kick into place and everything was fine. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Lanny. Did your experience with your, you know, your personal anxieties, I mean, did you ever share that in the way that your character Donnie does with his so-called best friend, Jesse Perry?
No, I never did. I kind of sat and chewed about it and didn't want to bother my wife with it. I had a friend in grad school with me who was a fellow artist that was also a new father. And after our children were born, we talked about those things, but not during the actual pregnancy, though.
So Lanny's experience in real life is a little different from what is portrayed in the play. Do you think it's the man cave influence, Kevin? Is that what opens these two guys up?
Well, I think it helps. I mean, the thing that's funny is I had never even heard of a man cave before this play. and then to find out you can get designer man caves is kind of absurd that, you know, that it's a guy's place to go hang out, that you have someone, you know, spend $100,000 to have them design your man cave for you. But it's definitely a guy's environment down in the basement, you know, trying to have I guess, just a moment of solitude from their wives. So,
what does the Salt Lake Acting Company man cave look like?
Of course, there's beer drinking involved, so there is a mini fridge, one character just talks about sports a lot. So I just went with the sports theme of the New York Yankees, and then the favorite sports teams of the playwrights, the Broncos.
Mm. The set is really magnificent, and every single detail. I mean, you could spend, it's like a museum. You could just walk in the set and look at everything. Kevin did not miss a beat of what this Raymond character, what his man cave would look like. Because man caves, like Kevin said, it could be from just a couch to a $50,000 room.
We're speaking with Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie and Lanny Langston from their production Manning Up by Salt Lake Acting Company. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Lanny Langston plays Donnie, and Jesse Perry plays his best friend Raymond. The entire cast is these two characters. Cynthia Fleming, what are the particular challenges to staging a two-man show as opposed to an ensemble cast?
Well, that's a really good question for Tracy and the director. First of all, I was trying to think of what she had said about it. First, she was worried about she didn't have enough time, but definitely with the two characters, you do have a lot of time to really explore and really have fun. Tracy is the type of director that she, and Lanny can speak to this, really a collaborative effort. And Lanny, why don't you talk about the direction of Tracy with two character play?
And I mean, how hard is it just to have you and one other character on for the entire duration, Lanny?
Yeah, it was something I hadn't done before, so I was a little bit worried about it going into the play. But once we started, it's actually been just really fantastic. Tracy just let us play a whole bunch, and You know, she was very, you know, she was kind of like a wizard in the way that she was able to combine our very unique energy throughout the play. But me and Jesse have just really clicked. And in a lot of ways, I'm almost starting to prefer two-man plays because I know what to expect from him every night. And he knows what to expect from me every night. And so it's been, you know, really nice. We've just got a good, trusting relationship together.
And Sean has written it as, you know, that they're not total opposites. They have this common theme between them. But the setup is very distinct between the two characters, which helps bring out the comedy.
Lanny, there's one point in the play where each of the characters is supposed to give a primal yell. How hard was that to kind of conjure up whatever that primal yell is and make it real on the stage?
I wish I had a good story for this, but I think we both found ours pretty easily, actually. But I think the one that was harder for me personally is, for both of us actually, is we're supposed to have a primal scream that doesn't sound very good. And those ones took a little bit more to find. But the actual primal screams, I don't know, I guess maybe we're both in touch with our inner primal man, so those came out pretty well.
No problem tapping into that. Speaking with Lanny Langston, he is playing Donnie in Manning Ups from Salt Lake Acting Company, and with us in studio, Cynthia Fleming and Kevin Myrie, executive producers of the company. At one point in the play, Raymond says that Raymond, the character, is an actor, and he has a role as a patient, and he's telling this pretend therapist that there are four kinds of dads growing up: dads who drank, dads who hit, dads who expected too much, and dads who ran away. Lanny, I mean, does that ring true to you?
You know, for me, my dad was so wonderful, and what ended up being kind of a trial for me when I was going was about to be a father, was living up to the amazing man that I thought my dad was. And so I would maybe add a fifth one to that. But I definitely have friends, you know, who have had abusive fathers or fathers who were constantly expecting things out of them that they couldn't produce. And so those do ring true, just not necessarily for me.
Some of these issues are going to be featured in a panel discussion that Salt Lake Acting Company is hosting coming up on Sunday, December 9th. Tell us about this, Cynthia.
Well, we're calling it Live from Slack's Man Cave, Men Unplugged, Babies and Bottles and Binkies, Oh My. And what it's inspired by the themes in this play, like you said, and we are asking two soon-to-be fathers, they're almost exactly like the characters in the play, Josh Martin and Zach Sloan. Their babies are due in December and January. And what's really fascinating about this play is, and it's what Lanny had said, yes, I had these fears, but I didn't tell anybody. And I think that's a normal thing for men. But then I'm wondering about the new generation of men, in which Sean is a very young writer. I think men are opening up. So we want to hear these new fathers open up about their fears. We also will have Joe Borgnicht and Dr. Louis Borgnicht, who were co-authors in The Baby Owner's Manual, Operating Instructions, Troubleshooting Tips, and Advice on Your First Year Maintenance. from the man's point of view on how to take care of a baby. And then, of course, we're going to have kind of a professional in gender studies, and to talk about, you know, men and how they communicate and their man cave. And this will be brought all together with Terry Gilday, who is the news director at KUER as the moderator. But that's what really fascinated me about this play, is these men opening up and feeling safe enough to, and do men now open up? And if they don't, why?
Salt Lake Acting Company's production of Manning Up. It continues through Sunday, December 9th in the company's Chapel Theater, 168 West, 500 North in Salt Lake City. And you can find out more information at saltlakeactingcompany.org or 801-363-SLACK. Of course, we'll have links on our website as well, kcpw.org. SLACK also presenting a free panel discussion live from SLACK's Man Cave, Babies, Bottles, and Binkies, Oh My. That's happening Sunday, December 9th at 4 o'clock. And Cynthia Fleming, Kevin Myrie, Lanny Langston, thanks so much for the time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, food, glorious food, and a new study that assesses how Salt Lake City is doing getting healthy food to its residents. So join us for that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.